Hi, I'm Kara O'Keefe.
And I'm Susie Rigdon. Welcome to the Fall for the Book podcast, part of the Watershed Lit Station. This season, we're sitting down with writers from across the genre spectrum. To hear all of our episodes, subscribe on SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Visit fallforthebook.org to find out more.
All right, Susie, today we're talking with Edward Cahill, and his debut novel is Disorderly Men, which looks at the lives of three gay men in New York in the early 60s. And I'm kind of really excited to talk about this book because right now a class I'm teaching is on recent American fiction, and it's looking at 21st century fiction, but everything we've looked at so far are contemporary novels that are engaging with like different historic periods throughout U.S. history. So I really, really enjoyed Disorderly Men just because it felt like such an interesting complement to some of the stuff I'm teaching right now.
Yeah. And you know, I know we, in sort of our recent history, we've talked to a number of folks who write in historical fiction, but it's been very sort of distant past. It's been, you know, Reconstruction era, or we'll be talking to a writer who's writing about, you know, in the 20s. But the 60s is such recent history that it's a very interesting sort of spin on historical fiction. You know, how are you writing historical fiction when so many people grew up in the 60s or, you know, came of age?
It's historic, but it's still in living memory for a lot of people. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about Disorderly Men. Edward Cahill is professor of English at Fordham University. He's the author of Liberty of the Imagination, Aesthetic Theory, Literary Form, and Politics in the United States. Disorderly Men is his first novel. Edward, thank you so much for being here with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Kara. Thanks.
Well, we're really excited to talk about Disorderly Men, which takes place in pre-Stonewall New York. And so I think a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with sort of this era, but for those who aren't, could you talk a little bit about what life was like for queer people living in New York City in the 60s?
Sure, Susie, thank you. It's very, very different than we understand queer life now. There was no queer community. Resources were few and far between. And you know, there was such a backlash against the mobilization of queer people, you know, in the post-war era, that there were laws, really in most major cities, called lewd vague laws, where you could be arrested more or less for anything, if you were wearing the wrong clothing, or if you were dancing with the wrong person, or simply just expressing yourself, you could be arrested. Between 1922 and 1966 in New York City, over 50,000 men were arrested under these laws. So many lives ruined. So it's a time when what we now know as the gay community was emerging, but it was doing so under the most sort of high pressure circumstances. And so it was a real risk to claim your identity and to pursue your desire. And people did it, but it was dangerous.
One of the things I thought was really interesting is sort of the vagueness of the term disorderly conduct. And that's something that Danny, one of your narrators, really thinks about, is like, what does that even mean? You know, and then just what I think is really shocking is like, not only is this, you know, you're arrested, but they fully doxed you. They published your name, your address, where you worked, all of that good stuff in the newspaper if you were arrested. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, you know, one of the things Danny says, I don't think this is a spoiler, is that you know, these newspapers were, the newspaper reports about the bar raids were just, I mean, they were so destructive, but they were also the way you found out where the bars were. Because, you know, there were no gay newspapers, you know, there was no gay websites, and you didn't know a lot of gay people. So that's how you found out where to go. So, you know, that meant really sort of heading into very, very dangerous waters, but people did it because they wanted to connect.
That's really interesting. Like you said, there was no real community in the way that we might think of it now. And in fact, the novel begins with one of those queer bars being raided by the police. So it's already, the characters are already in this very high pressure situation. Why did you feel like that was the right moment to start this particular story?
Well, I wanted, you know, the raid is the catalyzing incident that transforms the lives of three men. So I didn't want to waste any time. I wanted to get right there, and then to see how these three different men respond to what is essentially an existential crisis. You know, the police raid, you know, probably means arrest, probably means exposure. And as far as they're concerned, their lives really are at stake. And that's, I think, in a lot of ways, what the book is about is, you know, confronting the question of how valuable your life is and whether or not it's something that you can live with dignity. You know, the raids, as I understand them, I've never been in a raid, but they were terrifying, absolutely terrifying. But I think they were also very clarifying for some people in terms of understanding what, you know, we as gay people were up against.
It's a really powerful moment to like meet those characters for the first time. And absolutely.
And the fear or sometimes rebellion at the same time is so visceral. And, you know, you mentioned your three characters. So the book is told from three different perspectives and they're so very different. We've got the married businessman, Roger, the literature professor, Julian, and then young Danny, who gets, you know, is just kicked out of his conservative Irish home. How did you settle on those three different perspectives and how did their voices help you shape your novel?
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, if I could have, I would have told a much more representative story of queer life in New York City in 1962. But I could only do what I could do. So I wanted the most diverse, characters that I knew well. And I wanted more than one because gay men in the in the 50s and 60s, they sort of found themselves by finding each other. I wanted these characters to meet each other, to interact with each other as a way of kind of figuring out who they really were. I wanted them in sort of different stages of outness. Now, you know, nobody's really out in 1962. You know, my editor sent me some copy at one point describing the book about three closeted gay men. And I thought everybody was closeted in 1960. Maybe, you know, James Baldwin wasn't closeted. Everybody else was closeted. But Roger's deeply closeted and Danny is really on his way out to being, you know, completely open. Julian's kind of somewhere in the middle. And so with these different sort of degrees of outness, you also have sort of different ways of dealing with shame. And I think that's another big theme in the book. You know, Roger's shame has so much to do with the very idea of being gay. With Julian, it's a little bit different. He's really sort of trying to understand who he is in terms of love and what it might mean to love. So they're sort of approaching this question of who they are in very different ways, also based on kind of their socioeconomic status, the kind of intellectual and cultural social resources that they have at their disposal.
Yeah, that was definitely one thing that I noticed just is how really openly homophobic Roger can be to others and how he observes them and very much himself. There's so much self-hatred that's there. Whereas, you know, like you said, Danny's sort of very open and curious and it's so interesting. He's coming to terms with the ideas of being deplorable. That was the word he was thinking about, you know, after his arrest and then sort of everything that Julian's going through as well. So it sounds like, you know, these details are very specific to them, but also very sort of representative of sort of societal expectations or societal norms sort of at the time. Is that, you feel like that's pretty close to what the experience might've been like for some people?
I think so. I mean, the laws that I was talking about were really laws aimed at invisibility, keeping queer people invisible, right? We knew that there was no way of actually getting rid of queer people. We were always going to be here. But laws tried to make it so that no one ever had to see them or hear for them or think about them. And, you know, a character like Danny is really kind of seeing that. He's seeing that very clearly. And, you know, we talk about queer visibility now as a kind of, you know, political tactic. I think Danny's sort of recognizing that all you have to do is declare yourself and everything changes, right? Everything changes. Families have to confront the truth. You know, each of my characters kind of as they sort of confront these very, very hard questions has a little bit of a change of perspective. And I think that change of perspective is something that's happened. It happened very gradually in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and then maybe in the 90s and later on, it started speeding up. But, you know, it's a it's a taboo. It's a taboo, and nobody approaches a taboo casually. And once that taboo has been named, everything begins to change. And I think Danny's the one who sees that most clearly. And we're seeing Roger and Julie in kind of different stages of recognizing what happens if you tell the truth.
I think it's really interesting thinking about, like you said, these laws are sort of aimed at invisibility, making it so the rest of the world doesn't have to think about the queer community. But then the result of some of these raids is having your name published in the paper. So there's this strange connection between like that attempt to keep things invisible, but also using this kind of form of public shame too.
Yeah, and you know the language of those of that public shaming, like perversion. You know, by and large, in 1962, if you were arrested for disorderly conduct or you know lewd vague laws, you were considered both criminal and very likely mentally ill. So there were sort of ways of categorizing queer people that just automatically marginalized them. And so even if the love that dare not speak its name actually does get spoken, it's in such a way that those who are labeled in that way don't you know they experience a kind of social death.
So we've kind of heard a lot about like the laws that ended up impacting these characters and in this story. It sounds like there was quite a bit of research that went into doing this. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about what your research process was for this book and if there are any particular stories or facts you discovered that were interesting to you, but that maybe didn't make it into the book.
Well, you know, I'm a researcher by profession and training. But as I've turned to fiction, which has been a wonderful journey of the last 8 years, I realized that that research works very, very differently when you're writing a novel. And so my approach was to learn as much as I can and then forget about it. Because I didn't want to wear my research on my sleeve. I didn't want to be sort of stumbling over facts. What I really wanted was to get the look and feel of 1962, and to understand how people thought and you know what they said, but also the way they responded to the world around them. I you know, because I'm a historicist, I wanted to make sure I didn't get anything wrong. I didn't make any actual historical mistakes, but I wanted to kind of create a world that that wasn't so much a world of facts, but a world of feelings. Another Country by James Baldwin is also set in 1962. It's a book that really inspired me to think about this period. I think just I certainly did a lot of research, but I think in the end, my approach to getting the period right was less empirical and more aesthetic. I mean, there were so many interesting things that happened in 1962 that I didn't ultimately include. You know, the story takes place in February of 1962. You know, 1960 was really sort of on the cusp of major social change in the United States. In 1963, you have Kennedy, you have the Beatles, you have, the 60s really beginning in 1962. So they're kind of the 60s are beginning in 63, they're ending in 62. And I wanted to be right there with a feeling that everything is about to change, but it hasn't changed just yet.
You know, New York City it also feels like a very sort of timeless place. And so we just sort of slip in. We know these locations, even if we don't necessarily know them in the 60s. And then we have like all those really nice subtle details that you include. Including, I love Roger's wife just like listing all the current events. You know, wanting to talk about all these hot button issues. But you know, you talked a little bit about what people are saying and how they respond. And that was one of the elements that I thought was really interesting is with these hidden lives or these hidden halves of themselves or their whole selves. It really stood out how much of these men's public interactions, specifically Roger, because he is so deeply, deeply closeted. all of his interactions are parsed for double meaning. I'm thinking of one conversation where the person says, oh, that's not my cup of tea. And he like focused on that phrase, like, oh, is this what I think it means? Is this what's going on? And so like on a craft level, how do you approach sort of representing this double life through very small pieces of dialogue?
Oh, it's a good question. I don't know, you try 1,000 times before you get it right. You know, I think Roger is both, he understands that T has certain resonances because he's been around a little bit. You know, he had a lover. He's had love interests, but he's always been kind of not quite in any kind of a gay circle. So he's both in and he's out. And I think, in fact, that's really the way most gay men in the 1950s and 60s live their lives. They're in and they're out, and they're often in places like the hotel bars that I describe in the novel, where men were ostensibly straight, and they're in this sort of masculine domain. And within that masculine domain, all sorts of things can happen in a very, very coded way and in a relatively safe way because it's so masculine. So I think, you know, being in the military, being in you know, the business world, Roger is often in these sort of all male environments, and he understands that a little slip of the tongue can send a very special message to someone who understands it. How to get that right? I wish I could answer the question about craft, but I don't know. I just kept trying until I think I got it.
It's all revision. It's always all revision. Yes. I want to talk a little bit about Julian as a character too. You mentioned a little bit earlier that that some of your previous background is more in like academic research and writing. But I was curious about how that might have ended up being reflected in a character like Julian, who is an academic and teaches classic literature. And seems like someone who is very much shaped by some of what he reads.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm an English professor, but I'm not a Shakespeare professor. In fact, I've taught Shakespeare and I've taught Milton. It's not my specialty, but I knew that I wanted Julian to be an early modernist because I knew that the arc of his story was really about love, and the ability to crack open a heart that has been so guarded and so oppressed by fear and shame. And you know, poetry has always been one chief way that people come to understand what love is and how it works. You know, Julian spends a real long time all through graduate school and his first years teaching at Columbia, working on his monograph, thinking about love. And it turns out he doesn't really understand love very well. And it takes the actual experience of love to see it more clearly. You know, these were sort of resources that I had. I'd always kind of wanted to write, the English department satire. This was not that novel exactly, but it rendered him, he needed to be very different from Roger. I wanted him to be in a very, very different world from Roger so that as they connected, their connection would have a lot of friction. And it seemed like uptown at Columbia and downtown on Wall Street was the best way to do that.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And yes, there certainly are some characters in the Julian's department. And it's fascinating to watch him, as you know, Kara and I both teach in the English department at Mason. It's really interesting to watch his like thought process as he's going over his manuscript and he's like, well, if I tell the truth, this is unpublishable, but if I want to publish it, you know, just sort of like going through all of those. And you know, speaking of writing and publishing, you mentioned that your fiction journey has been about 8 years now, and we sort of listed some other titles that are very academic. So with Disorderly Men as your first novel, when did you realize you wanted to write fiction? Was that 8 years ago? And, you know, how did you sort of settle on this book and move through that journey?
When I was a very young man, I quit my job as a staff assistant to a congressman and decided I was going to be a fiction writer, which meant waiting tables. And I did that for 2 years and I had zero success. So I said, what should I do? Okay, I'll go to grad school. And I traded the risk of an artistic life for a salary, and, you know, regularly scheduled classes. And you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed being a scholar. My first book was really, really interesting. I started working on a second book, really, really interesting. And I found myself on sabbatical, sitting in the New York Public Library, surrounded by books and about, you know, 100,000 words in this project that I've been working on for so long. And I decided I just wasn't going to finish it. You know, academia is in real transition right now, and there are, you know, fewer and fewer openings, you know, for tenure track positions. And so my question was, who's going to read this book that I write? Who's going to read this book? You know, I'm sure no more than 100 people read the first book. I wanted a bigger audience. Even though I felt like I had a lot to say in this book, which happened to be a cultural history of upward mobility in the early modern Atlantic world, so very, very different from 1962, but I wanted a bigger audience, and you know, at that point I had tenure, I could take this kind of risk, so I just did it, and I started just by writing a couple of chapters and asking myself, could this be a novel? Could this work? And it just kept working and it just kept feeling good. And talk about like that for me, just the best SSRI is writing fiction. It just makes me feel so good. I love writing. I'm not one of those writers who suffers in writing. Writing just makes me feel good, but writing fiction really was so liberating and allowed me to think about history and culture and language and all the ways that I like to do, but could also be so much more personal and so much more intimate and so much more dangerous. And so once I started, I just got addicted.
You mentioned a little bit earlier, James Baldwin. I think the book you brought up was Another Country, but I actually wanted to ask about Giovanni's Room, because you open up the second part of the book with a quote from Giovanni's Room, perhaps home is not a place, but simply an irrevocable condition. And you've talked about like teaching Baldwin, like this year in particular is an interesting time to be talking about him. It's the 100th anniversary of James Baldwin's birth. So I'm curious about like why you chose this particular quote, and maybe even like this particular book.
Well, Giovanni's Room is a book that I love. I teach it all the time. It's been so interesting to teach it, to watch how students have responded differently over the years. You know, when I taught it 15 years ago, students had a hard time saying that David was a homosexual. And now kids come in and they just say, yeah, David's queer. He's having a hard time dealing with it. You know, he needs to just accept himself and come out of the closet. I've loved the journey that Baldwin puts David on. You know, David is just immersed in shame and self-loathing, and it just causes so much trouble for him. I think Baldwin's understanding of shame and how it works really inspired my novel with the character Danny, but the others as well. And you know, there's a rawness and a candor in Baldwin's portrait of David that has just always been so inspiring to me. And I think the you know, the language of Giovanni's Room and Another Country really also kind of inspired the tone that I was going for in this novel. You know, a kind of a mid-century tone, definitely not a 2023 was the year it was published tone, but something kind of more classic, some blend of maybe, you know, Richard Yates and James Baldwin and John Cheever, to feel like we're really there. Now, Baldwin was the kind of writer who would say he wouldn't hold back. A lot of sort of queer mid-century stories are euphemistic because they had to be. But what's so nice about Baldwin is that he would just say what needed to be said. And I think that's one of the great things about gay fiction right now is that I mean, gay historical fiction, so we can go back into these moments and say what couldn't be said back then. But Baldwin really has inspired me to just say it.
I really like seeing the connection between Baldwin and this novel. It just felt so resonant.
And I think the irrevocable condition for David is his queerness. And you know, in my novel, each of the characters very, very focused on the idea of home and what home means and how home works and how they can feel like they have a home. And, you know, so the question is, in what way does their journey here, does their struggle give them that sense of home that is a solid identity, a solid a sense of who they are and a comfort in knowing that that's okay.
Yeah, and it feels so significant at this time that you're talking about where there really wasn't a community. Well, thank you, Edward, for talking with us today. It's been really great hearing more about the book.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for your enthusiasm. I appreciate it.
The Fall for the Book podcast is produced by Jordan Bostick as a part of Watershed Lit. For more episodes, you can follow us on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Fall for the Book is a nonprofit literary arts organization, and you can find more information about our programs and events at fallforthebook.org.